Well, since most people didn't, oh, you're all hiding in the back? Doesn't this seem a little silly in a classroom this size with so few people? Come on, move up so we can talk. All right, so I said Monday that, well, actually, I induced you to say Monday that the best way to reduce bugs was to reduce code. Which is true. But there's another aspect to reducing code, which is, look, if I hand you a million line body of code and ask you to do anything useful with it, right, what's the first thing you're going to do? Okay, panic, but after that. Next thing you're going to go looking for an automatic weapon to take to me, because that's like the other solution than actually doing something with the code, is to make the problem go away, as it were. So what are you going to do with a million lines of code? What?
Search for a
Oh, you're going to hope somebody did documentation. And you know, then you're going to reach for some kind of automatic code analysis tool, because, I mean, never mind working on it, this is too big to even browse. And the LXR browser for the Linux kernel is tolerable, mostly because that body of code is actually pretty well structured. I mean, sort of drivers have a relationship with the rest of the Linux kernel, but at least in theory, they don't have any relationship with unrelated drivers. A lot of sort of structure in the system that helps you. And by and large, in something that size, you hope that will be true, but reality is often a different thing. So one of the other benefits of shrinking code size is you simply get the massive stuff down to the point where you have some hope of wrapping your head around it and dealing with it. And the problem, particularly in kernels, in language runtimes, is you make a seemingly innocuous change in one place. Right. It has a consequence over in the other corner of the system. And if the other corner of the system is 10,000 lines of code away, you got a fighting chance of remembering where all the corners are. Corners is sort of an unfortunate metaphor, because it's not like we're dealing with a cube here. But if the body of code is 100,000 or a million lines of code away, you haven't got a prayer in hell of figuring out where all the other corners are. And at least sort of a rough experience-driven number, I'm not going to claim this number is accurate, but it's, you know, sort of in the right basic range. An experienced programmer, how much code you can keep in your head depends on the complexity of the code and the structure of the code. But for complex code, an experienced programmer who's really talented can do about 15,000 lines in your head. The code gets easier, the number gets bigger. But things like kernels and runtimes aren't simple pieces of code. One other thing I want to throw into that is, so what's the hardest problem, hardest pragmatic problem in computer science today? There's some really, really hard theory problems, right? But I'm not trying to get after those. What's the hardest pragmatic problem in computing today? What?
Search.
No, search is actually an embarrassingly easy problem. The fact that we don't know how to do it doesn't make it fundamentally hard. It's also an embarrassingly parallel problem. But I mean, sort of, okay, I agree that that's an important application today, right? I'm after sort of more fundamentally, right? There's some fundamental tools that we use pragmatically in everything we do in computer science. There are sort of fundamental problems that we deal with. We deal with memory management, we deal with storage systems, we deal with sort of all kinds of things. What's the hardest one? The one on which, as a field, we have the least handle. Concurrency. Tools we have for dealing with concurrency, in a word, suck. And it's not because we know what to do and we haven't built the support into the tools yet. It's because we haven't the foggiest clue what to do in a general sense. Compounding that, we have a long history of programming idioms that are not very friendly to concurrency. An example. So in the Linux kernel or the Unix kernel or the Windows kernel or in fact most kernels, right, you've got a user versus supervisor boundary, and you have a crossing, a system call or an interrupt, something forces you into the kernel, okay, and you proceed off merrily down the kernel stack, and at some point you get to a place where whatever it is you want to do, you can't do it now. Or you need some resource, or something's not a page, or somebody else is in the way, but there's some reason you have to wait. Maybe the device is temporarily blocked. You want to write a block to the disk, but there are no more entries in the disk's queue of blocks. Wait. Now, here's the catch. In a large system, well, in any system, things that tend to cause you to have to block are things that happen, logically speaking, near the leaf of the design, near the leaves of the design, right? You don't block because you need more stack, right? You don't block because you're entering the file system. You block because a particular write to a particular file was blocked, or a particular low-level operation on a disk was blocked. Or sometimes you block because you need access to a highly concurrent data structure and somebody else is using it right now. That kind of blocking tends to be done with something called a spin lock. It tends to be a very ephemeral notion of blocking. What I'm talking about here are the kinds of blocks where there's reason to actually really give up your CPU to somebody else. Well, if you're at the leaf of a complicated, or at one of the leaves of a complicated system, how deep is your stack? Hello, deep, what do you think? Deep. Why? I'm sure you know, so long. Why is it likely, and there's no guarantee, but why is it likely that the stack is going to be deep at that point? A shot at that?
I don't know if I understand.
Well, if I'm looking for a disk block and I have to sleep,
okay.
Have I just entered the kernel where I would have a shallow stack? Or have I made lots of calls and now I'm at a deep stack?
Yeah, you're like waiting for files.
Okay, so why is it likely that I'm at a deep stack?
Because you've had to go through a lot of different files and components.
Right. We've done a lot of traversal through relatively generic code, right? Or dispatching code or demultiplexing code. And we're now down at the level where we're actually trying to do something useful, right? So, you know, if we were going to make up a story and draw an arbitrary line on this stack, right? Everything above that line was stupid, right? It was overhead to get to this thing at the bottom that was what we actually wanted to do. Okay, so if I have a big stack, what's on the stack? Idea? Me neither. Okay. It's anybody's guess what's on the stack. I don't know what path it took through the kernel. I mean, if we know something about the design, we may have a story. But there are an awful lot of paths that will get me to a disk block at the end. I don't even know if I started doing networking or file systems, because this could have been an NFS request. I have pointers on the stack, right? Those pointers point to data structures. And if I'm in a concurrent system, those data structures are structures on which either I hold locks or my code is wrong. Pick one. Or I'm using some other concurrency discipline, possibly. But the point is, I'm using a concurrency discipline, and part of what's happening here is to get to this point in my code, I made other calls that examined data structures that said, oh, you know, what's the state of this data structure? Based on the state of this data structure, I'm going to go one way or the other way on some decision I'm making in the code. I made an awful lot of those decisions. And the continuation that I'm at right here, the point in the execution that I'm at, is in some sense predicated on those decisions that I made, right? That's how I got here. If any of those decisions move out from under me, then this isn't the right place to be anymore. The only way to stop those things from moving out from under me is some form of concurrency discipline, which in practice usually means locking. Not always. There are other disciplines, but they're much, much harder to manage. So not only do I have pointers sitting on this stack, but I have pointers to objects that are locked. And every one of those locks is a reason that somebody else might not be able to make progress. Now, how much work have I done to get to this point in the stack? Oh, a lot. Hundreds of instructions, thousands of instructions, millions of instructions, billions of instructions. We can do this in units of, you know, semi-seconds. Thousands of instructions. I think so. I mean, are you guessing or do you have numbers?
I'm not guessing.
That's okay. I mean, I asked for a guess. I didn't ask for a guess. It's better than no answer at all. So if you're in a microkernel, you may be as low as thousands. If you're in the Linux kernel, fair likelihood you're in millions. It's not just the millions of instructions, it's the number of locks you've taken. So this stack in the Linux kernel represents a huge commitment to work that you would really like not to have to do again. And what happens when a Linux process sleeps is it sleeps with that stack intact and with all of those locks held. How long is it going to sleep? What might we speculate? You know, what would we need to know in order to speculate about how long it's going to sleep?
How long the other
operations? Okay, but what? Okay, so how would we know what those operations might be? How could we constrain? I mean, there's a large pool of operations in the system, right? What are the operations that are relevant?
I guess file system, offset writes.
Well, if we're doing the disk write case, it's disk operations, right? If we're doing a network case, it's network operations. If we're doing a file system case, it's file system operations, right? So how long we're going to sleep depends on what we're sleeping on. To some degree, it depends on how many other people need it. Although, in practice, what you observe in real systems is there's a small number of places that are hotspots where you see a lot of contention for a data structure. By and large, most other locks are not contended for. If they are, they're only contended for by one other party. There's a very bimodal distribution in this. And it has to do with sort of the way control structures seem to work out in these systems. Scheduling lock tends to be a very high contention lock. Everybody wants it all the time. Okay, so suppose it is a disk operation. You know, I'm waiting for a block to come in. How long is that going to take? Well, let's imagine I'm doing an IO. So I've initiated the fetch of a block. How long is that likely to take? 1 millisecond. How many milliseconds? Pick a drive. The order of tens. Okay, so when was the last, well, I would have said, when was the last time you went down to CompUSA, but if you haven't done it recently, you're not going in or again. When was the last time you went down to Best Buy and looked at a drive? Or Newegg, if you prefer. Looking at that sexy gigabyte drive that, you know, that you can't really afford, but that's the one you're going to buy because it's the most bang for the buck, right? So what's the seek time on that drive? Last time you looked at a drive, what was the seek time? What? Yeah, typical commodity drives now are running 9 millisecond seek times, give or take. Right? You can get faster drives for RAID applications. They're tiny. You don't want them in your PC. Nobody in the real world uses them either. Okay? What are the rotation speeds on this drive? Typically 7200. Right? You basically see two categories of drive in the market today. You see the laptop drives, which are either 4800 or 5400. Okay, and you see the high-end drives, which are either 7200 or 1000, 10,000. You'll occasionally see a 5400 drive in the commodity market. Run, do not walk, forget it, it's too slow. How many rotations are you gonna do on average to get that block? You guys done disk systems? Okay, so if I have a singly linked list of some depth K, and I'm looking for some element in that list, on average, how many elements am I going to have to go through to get the element that I'm after? Two, right? So it turns out that a rotating disk looks kind of the same way. The reason is a little different, okay, because it is a circle, right? So there's a continuous thing. The piece I don't know is at the moment that my head comes over that cylinder, right, where is it in its rotation? All right? And it could be right at the block I need, and it could be right after the block I need, in which case I'm going to have to go around again. On average, I'm going to go around, the theory says, half a rotation. If I'm doing a write with a check, I'm going to do a rotation and a half. So who's got a calculator? What's the time for a rotation here? Revolutions per minute. Okay, so it's 120 revolutions a second. Call it 100 to keep the math simple. Okay, so we're in the 10 milliseconds per rotation range. Didn't screw up my math. By the way, I'm infamous for screwing up my math, so don't trust my math. The only person I know who does math on his feet worse than I do is John Hennessy. Okay, so that's sync. Okay, and then, so I'm going to take on average, by the way, it's closer to 9 milliseconds when we work out the 120. It's going to end up in like the 8.7 range. So on average, we're going to do a 4 millisecond rotate. Again, I'm doing round numbers. That's perhaps a little rounder than the one before. So 13 milliseconds. Now, be wary of that 9 millisecond number. That is an average of random syncs. I've never observed a disk to do a random sync because you're always after something in particular. And if you know that you're always after something in particular and you're not a total idiot, you don't put things in random locations on the drive. You put them where they're ready to hang. So that 9 millisecond number is a very tunable number if you have a smart file system. But that rotation number, man, there's like nothing you can do about it. That's not quite true. If you're doing things like a database log, there's a lot you can do about it. But if you're looking for some particular block that's like not localized, you're going to eat the rotate. There's nothing you can do. Okay, what's the clock rate on my processor? And let's be generous and assume we're only talking about a single core for the moment. Last time I saw one of those actually shipping was about 3 years ago, outside of the embedded space. You go out and buy a processor, right? There's some number that tells you its speed, right? And then there's some unit after it. What's the unit? Gigahertz, right? So in those 13 milliseconds, how many instructions am I going to piss away waiting for the disk to get there? A whole lot. A whole lot. That's a huge number of instructions. It's not quite a giga instructions. It's about half a giga instructions, round numbers, is what point. Even if I did, it's a lot. So one of you said, well, it's not really such a long time. Which the answer is, gosh. That's a really good reason to give up the CPU to something else. Catch. Guess what the next processor wants to do? It wants to modify some piece of state on which you're holding a lock. And it turns out locking disciplines are really, really hard to do. And it turns out that even if you get them right, there's an interesting problem. One way to think about this stack path, and I will drag this back kicking and screaming to the topic of microkernels in a minute, there's actually a point buried in here, is that I have a path that did a bunch of reads at the bottom of which there was some update to the state of the system. It doesn't describe all paths. There are paths that do a sequence of states updates, and they do some reads after the state updates. Those are very important, very, very unfortunate. That's what I'm actually getting to. Our proposition is we're going to sleep between the reads and the writes. And somebody else is going to run in that time interval, maybe multiple somebodies else. And they're going to do their reads and writes. Notice what I now have is interleaving of operations. Now, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with interleaving of operations. Indeed, a lot of what we're after in concurrency is to achieve interleaving of operations. And if all of the operations were to work in this way that I've described as a bunch of reads followed by a write, and if we held locks correctly, this interleaving is okay. I mean, okay in the sense that when it's over, I can still tell you whether the system is in a well-defined state. Fortunately, a very large number of operations in real kernels don't follow that pattern. The pattern they follow is they do a bunch of setup, they do some write, they do some more setup, they do some write, they do some more setup, they do some write. And now what you have is interleaving is not a whole operation and a whole operation and a whole operation, but interleaving is where half of my operation got done, some of your operation got done, some of his operation got done, some of her operation got done. Oh, we came back and did a little more of mine. You know, you got done, she got done, and now I'm still waiting for this block. And when we're done unwinding that, I can't tell you a story. The question is, when this is all over, right, at the start of this, there was some state of the system. And at the end of this, there was some state of the system. The question is, can I tell you a story about some well-defined sequence of legal operations that could have transformed the system from the first state at the beginning to the last state at the end? If the answer is no, you don't have a consistent system design. Something you'd like to have if you care about it running for any length of time. Okay, so observation, what you want if you want a consistent system design is you want a system that is structured in terms of what hardware people call a unit of operation. Unit of operation is an indivisible, logically indivisible piece. It either all happens or none of it happens. Now you can cheat in various ways. Updating caches doesn't really count. That doesn't logically change the state of the machine. It sure does at the hardware level, right? But that's not the level of abstraction that we're looking at from the operating system perspective, at least not most of the time. We'd like it to be the case that when this was all over, obviously these operations did not happen in a serial order, but we'd like to be able to tell a story that describes their effect in terms of some serialized sequence of their operations. This is the serializability property that you talk about in the database world. We'd like to see it in general in systems that have to be well-defined. Turns out, it's almost impossible to get it in a system that works this way. Sooner or later, usually sooner, somebody will add an operation that sleeps in the middle, holding locks, holding state, and you've just lost it. One of the things you get when you shrink the code of a system, you shrink the depth of its stack. Intuition, right? If there are only 10,000 lines, and I actually execute all of them, how deep can the stack possibly get? Well, it depends on how badly I do recursion. But in real systems, recursion tends to be something that's fairly sharply bounded. Or it's time to redesign your system. I mean, it's not hard to design kernels whose stack depth has a known upper bound. At least has a known upper bound for a given amount of physical RAM, right? There are things where you have to do sorts on RAM, and you may have an algorithm that has a log n factor on the size of your RAM. But log n factor on the size of your RAM is still pretty small. So one of the things you get if you can shrink to code size is you recover the ability to engineer a system that incorporates this units of operation idea. And this idea is not present in Linux. It's not present in Windows. It was not present in VMS. I don't believe it was present in IBM's OS. Seems to be a microkernel kind of idea. Or at least, that's not fair. I think a better way to say it is, it's an idea that the really talented OS designers know about, but it seems to be pragmatically out of reach in large-scale kernels. Not that people are ignorant of this, it's that they don't know how to do it in the scales that they're operating on. Okay. So having used a term too much without defining it, what's a microkernel? So if I want to throw the code out, if I want to shrink the code size, and one way is to say, well, I'll start from the iron and I'll engineer my way up and I'll put in exactly what I want, and then I'll declare victory. And that's actually probably the cleaner way to go about design. Unfortunately, it collides with the real world because then people say, well, I want to run those other applications from that other place, and you discover that you didn't consider that, and now you can't figure out how to be compatible with it, right? So the reality is always a compromise. The other approach is you could take some existing system and chuck stuff out. What that results in is an incoherent design that's just as bad as the original system but has less stuff in it. Because chucking stuff out is not the same as re-architecting. But if you're looking for intuition, what needs to be in a microkernel, that's a fine way to sort of approach the intuition. Once you get that picture, set it aside and build from scratch. So let's start with the Unix system, right? What is there that we could throw out that doesn't actually need to run in the kernel? Does the network need to run in the kernel? Right? Who do you want to take yes? Okay, why does the network need to run in the kernel?
Because it depends on the system, you need to keep the memory function.
Okay, I agree that that's a very important function. Why does that mean the network has to be in the kernel?
Well, it can directly use the
mushroom. Okay, so the argument I think you're making is that by keeping the network subsystem in the kernel, I will be able to eliminate data copies. Is that correct? So you're reaching for the intuition of the zero copy network stack. Is that about right? Yeah. So, good. So there's an assumption. So first, you're right. Getting to zero copy on the way out is possible and important. And you can't actually do it on the way in without programmable hardware support, but you can get to single copy on the way in. The problem being that you at least have to look at the packet to figure out how to demultiplex it, and to look at the packet, you have to take it. And I agree, from a performance perspective, that's a terribly important thing to do. But you're making an assumption, which is that we have to be in the kernel to do it. Why do we have to be in the kernel to do that? Okay. Why would something intrinsically have to be in the kernel? And what is it about the kernel that's different from the rest of the system? Directly interfaces with the hardware. Well, it's certainly true that most monolithic kernels do that, but is that an essential fact about them, or is that just an accident of their implementation? You're guessing, or you know? Okay. Yeah? Okay, so you're saying that there's certain activities that have to do with resource arbitration and protection. It seemed to be pretty primordial. And whether we call it a kernel or a runtime, whatever that core part of the system is, probably needs to know about those things and deal with them in some fairly first-class way. Or even if it doesn't deal with them, the exokernel is an interesting counterexample to that. But even there, where it doesn't really deal with the resources themselves directly, it at least provides underpinnings so that external resource managers have a clean interface and way of dealing with the world. Okay, I'll buy that, and I agree with that point. That's actually not what I'm after. Why? What is it that's fundamentally different about the kernel? Why can't I just pick up the Linux kernel and run it as an application? What's different about the environment in which it runs? Processor context. How?
Kernel.
Kernel has access to kernel mode. That sounds a little redundant.
Yeah. Well, isn't that what
it is? Okay, that's not kernel mode, right? One of them is a notion about kernel privilege level. The other is a notion about processor privilege level. And the point you're making is that they're tied together.
Yeah, I'm just trying to make...
Well, that's not true. Every time I run a process, I'm going to have to context switch. I don't have to context switch to do what?
If you have code that's running in the kernel process as opposed to driver outside, then every time you need to do it...
Is that expensive?
Could be.
What are we talking about?
What do you mean?
You're implicitly asserting that context switch is expensive, and because you're asserting we'd like to avoid it. Right? The reason to avoid it would be either that it's expensive or that the presence of that switch is going to force us to do data copies.
It's more expensive than not.
Is it?
Context switch.
Why?
For operation.
Okay, but now you're making the assumption that if I take the context switch out, switching from one process... You know what? Let me come back to this. You're on the trail of a good point, and I definitely want to pursue this point, but I want to finish the point I was on first. Okay. The difference is the kernel runs with the supervisor mode bit of the CPU turned on. That's it. Maybe a second difference is that the kernel has a physical address view of the world that it's entitled to use that's hard for applications to get to. So that can be fixed. I think it's fundamental. is that the supervisor bit is turned on. And that means you can do things like enable and disable interrupts. It means you can program hardware directly, although that can be enabled at the application level. So the real test is, I have to be in supervisor mode if there's some operation of the processor where if I'm not in supervisor mode, I can't do it at all. Anything that fits that definition, if I have to use that operation, that's got to be done in the kernel. I can then export it to applications with a system call. It has to be executed by code running in supervisor mode. Okay. Second thing is resource arbitration and protection. Why? It's not because I need to be in supervisor mode to run those algorithms. Last time I checked, you know, I could search a linked list at application level just fine. The reason that needs to be at supervisor level, and actually it doesn't, is, careful about this. Strictly speaking, the only thing that needs to be at supervisor level is context switching and inter-process communication. Maybe a system call for enabling and disabling interrupts. So you could imagine a hypothetical design in which I would take an existing kernel, I would run it as an application, I would write a tiny little piece of stub code. Every time you did a system call, it would copy the arguments from your process into this kernel process, and then the kernel would run just the way it does now. The only part of the system that would run in supervisor mode would be the communication transport between these two elements. And that design might or might not be feasible, but you could imagine that it could be made to work. And what you would mostly lose is the ability for the kernel process to directly access the address space of the client process. Well, so why should anything else run in supervisor mode? Assume, wave your hands, assume for a minute that you could solve the address space access problem, which, by the way, is hard to solve and not really solved in the microkernel literature in a satisfactory way. Assume you could. Why would you want anything else to run in supervisor? Speed. Why? And going back to his point that context switches have overhead, let me come back to that. Okay. What's the cost of running in supervisor? There's a price tag for doing that. What's the price tag?
If you have other processes that would otherwise not, otherwise, take out
of
address spaces would be.
So the power of the kernel, right, is that it runs with all the protections of the system turned off. Yeah. The hazard of the kernel is that it runs with all the protections of the system turned off, and any detail you get wrong is going to stay wrong forever and is highly likely to take the system out. And it's not a forgiving environment because there's no checks there. Your code really has to be right. And we've established yesterday or Monday how likely that is. So, right, look, the rule is if you want to get rid of the bug, shrink the code, right? And the most important place to get rid of the bugs, so if we were going to say, well, we've got 100 places we could be trying to get rid of bugs, what's the one to tackle first? It's the one where the consequences of a bug are most far-reaching or costly. Well, it doesn't get more costly than I take out your entire machine. So the most important place to get rid of bugs is in the supervisor. There's a strong argument, if you care about reliability, that assuming you can address these other issues, data motion and performance, that are real issues, shrinking the part of the system that runs in supervisor mode is an enormous win. Because if that fails, it's all gone, right? Okay, so let's come back to the performance argument. There's a hidden assumption in the argument you're making. The argument you're making is that you're trading a context switch against not doing anything at all, or perhaps against doing a procedure call. And I'll certainly agree that a procedure call can be done in units or tens of cycles. And a context switch, depending on the architecture, can be anywhere from tens of cycles on a decently designed RISC chip to thousands of cycles on, I hate to call it an architecture, but a Pentium. And those of you who've had any classes with me before know that I love the Pentium. So I think that's a false dichotomy. The reason I think it's a false dichotomy is one of the gains you get by context switching is you move your execution into an environment that is wholly independent from the environment that you came from. So the thing you know is I'm now running in a new process, and whatever concerns I had in the old process, they don't apply here. This is a different environment. It's a certain kind of isolation. That kind of isolation, if you don't have a process boundary, and you need it, you're going to have to build it somehow. And you're going to build it by means of locking, and you're going to build it by means of redundant data copies, and you're going to build it by means of selection of data structures. And when you look at it all, in the end, what you're going to discover is at best, you broke even versus the context switch. So the problem with the argument you're making, and that argument has been very popular in the literature for 40 years, is that it doesn't actually sustain itself when you look at the numbers. It establishes a false dichotomy and then kicks it around until it's, you know, all the straw's beaten out of it, but that doesn't make the dichotomy any less false. Data copy issue, I think, is much more compelling. Okay, and let me make an argument about the data copy issue that I'm not sure I completely believe. There are two reasons I might be forced to do it. In fact, there's really only one reason I might be forced to do a data copy. The reason I might be forced to do a data copy is I need some independence between my view of the data and your view of the data. If there's data that you can still modify, and I rely on the values being stable, then I either have to guarantee that you can't modify them, or I have to make a private copy. Similarly, and this was the tricky one in practice, if there's data that resides in storage, and you can take away the storage, and that a consequence of your taking away the storage is that I'm going to lose access, maybe when I'm in the middle of touching the data, again, I have to be defensive. In Unix, right, if I delete a file and you've got it open, the file doesn't really go away until everybody has closed it. It's a reference counting system. There are designs where when I delete a file, it's gone. And if you've also got it open, what happens now is you start getting errors. With shared memory, that's a hard thing to accomplish. If we want to avoid data copies, we're going to tend to move to shared memory designs. It turns out this is not a problem in practice. The reason it's not a problem in practice is in those scenarios where you care about zero copy networking, you can establish a shared buffer across the process boundary. You and I agree by prior arrangement, we're going to hand off our packets in this buffer. I've got access to it, you've got access to it. Do this at setup time. Once the buffer is set up, you simply put your data in this buffer and I take it out of there and we've got zero copy again. This buffer does have to be coordinated across the layers, but the evidence is that you can get out network performance, which is as good as the best zero copy design. That work was done by Anshumal Sinha here about 8 years ago now, 6 years ago. So yes, it's an issue, and actually buffer management across protection boundaries, I think, is the hardest issue in microkernel systems, but it can be managed. So going back to your argument about servers, I'm going to ask, so a server is a high-performance system, right? And we're going to do lots of things on it. And robustness in that environment might actually matter to us. So if we can preserve network performance, and I can point you at the reference, also getting robustness seems worthwhile. So back to my question, what could you take out? Because we're short of time, no reason for drivers to be in the kernel. There's no reason for file systems to be in the kernel. There's no reason for networking. And here's the intuition, right? If you go look at the Linux system and you say, what do I have left when all of the modules are discarded? What you discover is something actually manageably small, almost. Manageably small and badly designed, but manageably small. And clearly, if you could make it a loadable module and remove it, it had a well-defined interface boundary. It could have been isolated. I mean, what you gained by doing the module load was the ability to share pointers across these subsystems. What you lost was isolation. There actually has been work on running modules as application level code, and some of that work has been successful. There are some modules that actually aren't so modular. An awful lot of them are. But going back to context switch, okay, cost of a context switch now is down in the half microsecond range for a well-designed system. I mean, it's really quite low. That's not a number like this, right? That's a number where we're running a manageable number of instructions, and you can see that if I did enough locks, they might start to add up, because locks turn out to be surprisingly expensive to do. Locks are not just loads and stores. They're cross-processor operations, and they're often synchronizing operations. So if you go find a manual that will still tell you the number of cycles for things, because that's a harder and harder thing to pin down, look at the number of cycles for a load instruction, and then go look at the number of cycles for a compare and swap instruction. Compare and swap on the Pentium is like 40 cycles. And if you can do a context switch in hundreds of cycles, the gap's getting smaller. It doesn't take a lot of those compare and swaps to justify the context switch. And compare and swap is the thing that sits right at the center of the lock implementation. Well, some processors, there's another instruction that does it, but they all have this problem that they've got to do a very complex operation on memory, and so they take a while. Right. So what happens in a microkernel system is you say, oh, well, I'm actually going to throw all of that GORP out of the kernel. And what I'm going to get left with is a system that handles context switch. We handle something called IPC, inter-process communication. It does what I'm going to call real resource multiplexing, where you have a physical page or I have a physical page, but hopefully not both unless we intend to share it. And then once it's been allocated, we need a way to deallocate it. So there's a list of things that happen at this layer that some of them actually don't have to happen in supervisor mode, but what happens if you try to push them out of supervisor mode is you discover that there doesn't appear to be a clean way to generate an interface to do that. And what's being traded off here is there's hazard of doing this stuff in supervisor mode, but if there's no clean way to export it, there's also hazard in having complexity in the system. The two hazards have to be balanced against each other. Protection actually gets a little tricky. Think about protection in something like Unix or Windows. An awful lot of protection deals with things like files. You don't see access control lists on processes. Perhaps you should in that system, but in fact you don't. And notice that there's nothing in here that knows anything about files. Since the file abstraction is not known to the microkernel, it becomes hard for the microkernel to do any enforcement of protection on that abstraction. Certain kinds of protections that are generic. The notion of readability and writability are fairly generic. And I can more or less enforce them. If I have a read and a write system call and I at least know enough to know that there's a read and a write system call, if you're doing a write and the channel doesn't give you write permission, that's something that can be enforced pretty generically. Once you get past read and write permission, what you quickly discover is the permissions you want to enforce are very tied up in the semantics of the object. The protections we might do on network connections or on the network subsystem just wouldn't make any sense if we spoke about them in a file. I mean, you know, I want to put in a connection filter so that you can't connect to the porn site over next door, right? Now, talking about that in the context of the network connection agent makes a lot of sense. Talking about that in the context of the file system, I don't know what that would mean. It's a protection that's somehow inherently tied up in the kind of object you're talking about. And the idea here is we're going to push all of that responsibility out to service applications. It's not that we're not going to have a file system. It's that the file system is going to be run in an application that acts as a server that serves files. And you're going to talk to that server using this inter-process communication mechanism. That transport layer is going to convey enough information to the server for it to make access control decisions. Just as in Unix, right? It's actually the file system code that checks file-related permissions. That's still going to be true here. It's just that code is going to run at application level. I apologize if this has been a little disjointed because I haven't given you a clean picture of what a microkernel actually is because I spent a bunch of time arguing for what was the motivation for them. And the motivation is structure, to some degree size. If you're working on a desktop system, you have infinite resources. If you're working on an embedded system, even today, you don't have infinite resources. The most constraining resource is CPU performance probably today, but it's not infinite. You really want to be able to carve things back. Very hard to do in a monolithic system. If you strip a Linux system down as far as you can go, it's still pretty big. So, right. History. Probably the three systems to look at if you want to learn about microkernels, and I'll let you go because we're past time, although you guys came late. Mach was probably the system that really introduced the notion of microkernels, at least popularly within computer science. There were prior microkernels, but they weren't well written up in the literature. Mach, by the way, was a disaster, and it's debatable whether it was a microkernel. It's not clear when you look at the system if they threw out anything. Actually, they tried, and they couldn't make it work, and then they sucked a bunch of stuff back in. Another system you should probably look at is a system called L4. L4 was the work of someone by the name of Johan Liedtke. And L4 and its derivatives are probably the fastest microkernels out there today. They're actually starting to get deployed in cell phones, and in the various versions of this have been deployed in a number of applications. It's a well-known system. And the other one to look at, which, the one I'd like to tell you to look at is Kyoto's, but that's not sufficiently well written up yet, but it's the Eros system. And the difference between L4 and Eros, L4 is really trying to be a very, very, very thin microkernel, and it succeeds at doing that, but one of the key things it's missing is protection. And so Eros is a capability system which is a bit heavier than L4, but I think its major result, well, one of its major results is that you can have protection at no marginal cost, or marginal cost of only a few cycles. And its successor systems are now starting to get deployed in various applications again, and its predecessor systems were widely deployed. So on the microkernel idea, I'd look at those three. Historically, I might have said Chorus, but I think that the lessons of Chorus are now sort of hard to exhume unless you were there and understood what other issues people were fighting with at the time. Okay, we'll come back Friday and I'll pick up capabilities.
Yeah.